It's true, you know, hocus pocus, it's all where you focus. And this regen movement continues to gain ground, literally and figuratively. Today's first guest is Brent Habig, proprietor at Two Creek Farms in Pennsylvania. We decided to dive into the various aspects of scalability, and after hearing him mention the Real Organic Project, I had to find out what that was about. So second up is Lindley Dixon, the co-director and farmer in her own right at Adobe House Farm. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for August 2026. Grab your earbuds and or shovel and let's dig in. Brent, as we previously discussed, we're going to dive into a conversation about scalability and what you're observing and experiencing on your own farm. But first, I'd like you to share a mini story about how your previous work pointed you in the direction of buying land to farm regeneratively.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for this opportunity. It's a real pleasure to speak with you today. I started my career in the private sector. I did management consulting for a stint and then later shifted into international development. And I did quite a bit of work with economic development in Africa and Asia, living in Africa and Asia for pretty much two decades. And that work did involve then some significant concentration in agriculture, because agriculture is such a major economic opportunity in both Africa and Asia to build wealth for small families, producers. Smallholder agriculture is a really amazing opportunity in much of the world. So I had quite a bit of experience with agriculture. A lot of that, though, was funded by big organizations, including World Bank and USAID, as well as corporations, including Walmart and many global corporations. And after doing that work, I started to feel that it just wasn't leading to the systemic change that we need. Basically, I felt that working with these companies and even with governments, we were able to create projects at a small scale that seemed amazing at the pilot level, but to really scale them up to the point that they were real and standing on their own two feet just wasn't happening. And I felt that I was actually maybe a part of a larger greenwashing movement where maybe a lot of the work that I was doing for companies that maybe their practices in general were not particularly regenerative or supportive of small families and small farms. Maybe I was just giving them cover and giving them amazing PR around these small projects, but they really weren't evolving and adapting and taking this work seriously in terms of their core business. So after sort of feeling my way through that dilemma and concluding that, you know, I really wasn't driving change at the scale that I hoped, I just figured, well, at least I can go back and engage at a grassroots level and kind of shift to much smaller scale work myself and kind of do work that I believe in, that I feel has integrity, that I don't think is being used or repurposed for any type of greenwashing or other agendas. And I happen to have owned a farm in Pennsylvania that I never thought that I could ever farm. And I decided, hey, this is my chance. I've learned a lot about agriculture through this work. And why can't I now set this up so that it can be a regenerative farm? And that can not only help regenerate the ecosystem, it can help feed my community, but it also can be a training and demonstration farm. And that's essentially how I pivoted from international work with larger organizations to running Two Creek Farm.
Give us a verbal picture of your farm, where it is, geography, rainfall, livestock you keep, and how it was farmed previously, if it had been.
Yeah, so this was historically a dairy, and then they had converted to beef probably in the 50s and 60s, but it was not farmed for a number of decades. I purchased it in 2000. I'm in Lakewood, Pennsylvania. We're in northeast Pennsylvania. It's quite hilly in the northern Poconos. The original farm is 100 acres, and then later we acquired 500 acres. So we now are farming 600 acres, but most of that is woodland. Mm. So we have relatively small pastures. Our pastures in general are maybe between 3 and 10 acres each. We're currently running a wide range of agricultural enterprises. I'd say poultry is the largest. We do broilers as well as pasture-raised layers and turkeys. So that's a big part of what we do. We also farrow and finish forest-raised hogs for amazing forested pork. For ruminants, we have cattle as well as sheep, and that's one of the key engines of regeneration is all of that pasture work. We also have a no-till vegetable garden, and we have 32 beehives. So we have quite a range of enterprises on the farm, and they're all interconnected in a way that is supporting of ecological regeneration.
Yes, that certainly sounds like it. Using a description of scalability, maybe it would be a practical way to have you tell us how you looked at your farm when you got started and what came up regarding scalability and how you're actually going to put all of these things together that you have rolling now.
Yeah, well, maybe if I can just take a slight detour and also add that I am an accredited professional with the Savory Institute.
Yes,
so
lovely.
I'm actually a trainer and consultant in the field of holistic management. And holistic management offers a lot of tools to really think about farm management decisions and scale. But basically what that offers is a set of tools to really, I guess, inform these decisions at three levels. Ecologically, what do we want to happen? So what is the future resource base that we want to build? So the ecology is foundational to this. Another element to that is then what is the quality of life that I want to achieve as a farmer, including my family and other decision makers? What do we want as our experience of living on this farm? The other element of it is our economic goals and what do we need to accomplish in order for this to achieve whatever financial goals we may have. So it's basically, at some level, in a simplified way, it's a people, profit, planet type of a model that's looking at all of those three factors together to then determine, well, should we scale, should we not? Basically, any decision could be evaluated using this, it's called a holistic context, a way to make these decisions with respect to your specific goals for your farm. So how I thought about it as Two Creek, obviously I have to start listening to the land. What does the land tell you? What does the land need? What is the opportunity to regenerate through what is necessary ecologically? So we have a lot of forests, and those forests are overmature. So what that says is we have a huge opportunity for hogs to come in and offer disturbance and ultimately help evolve that towards more open civil pasture type systems. So, you know, that's clearly a strong message from the land. We can scale our hogs as much as we want. And then grazing, you know, we have pastures. We probably have, you know, in total, maybe 70, 80 acres of pasture, and they need to be grazed. So that says we're going to need a certain number of ruminants in order to keep on top of that. And we prefer a mix of cattle and sheep, and we can bring those to a certain scale, but not more, because at that point we'll be overgrazing and putting too many demands on our pasture. And then similarly with the poultry, you know, they're taking up land resources, and how might that compete with the grazing? And based on the quality of the pasture, do we need more fertility that the poultry is able to add? So basically, we look at all of those and try to say, well, what can this land carry? You know, I do have limits in terms of the amount of cattle that we can carry, but I don't have limits in terms of pigs and those enterprises. And the poultry also, they use much less land, and they're very helpful to add a lot of fertility. So the poultry we can scale up as well. So that begins to be a conversation with the farm itself about what it needs to flourish ecologically. Then the poultry, they create all of the compost that we use for our vegetable gardens. We can allocate a certain amount of land to veg production, but only as much as our poultry is able to fully fertilize. So everything's in a balance that really starts with the land as the clearest direction on what we should raise.
Right,
and,
yes.
How much of it to raise.
Yeah, when you work from that model, in a way you're being dictated to, but I just keep seeing there's so much freedom in all of that. In a way, decisions are made, and then you move along as best you know how in order to carry out those parameters that the land are showing you. And I love the phrase grazing in ecosystems restoration. Using the cattle, how many can you have? And you can address this, of course, with your poultry and pigs. How have you worked to stretch it, and what do you look for, and when did you say, oh, okay, this is too much, I have to sell some off, or we better just hold it right here with the numbers? Let's work with a few specifics.
Yeah. I guess to drill deeper, basically we follow a grazing model that is, again, coming out of the Savory Institute called holistic planned grazing. And that helps us plan the grazing for a whole season. And it helps us understand these questions, but that takes a full training to go through. So I guess to simplify that, the number one factor in grazing is giving the land enough time to recover.
Yes.
So it's really about taking the animals off the land for long enough that the grass fully regrows. If that happens, then that pasture will continue to improve again and again each graze. But if we go back there too soon and we're grazing before it's fully regrown, then we're just depleting the energy base in that pasture. So we use a system where we're moving our ruminants daily. It's not so much to put them on new grass, it's to take them off the grass that they've grazed. Except for that day that they're grazing, it has the entire rest of the season to recover. Whereas if we just had two paddocks, then they were on one or the other, then it would basically only be able to recover for half of the season. Whereas our land is able to recover for over 99% of the season because of how we're moving the animals. But the question is, moving them at that pace, at what point are they not getting enough forage to grow at the rate that we expect them to grow? And at that point, we know, wow, you know, we're hitting a system limit. And then you either have to put them on hay early, or you have to identify some flexible pastures for them to move onto. But I think we have it pretty well planned out where we're able to handle, you know, more or less one animal unit per acre is kind of the rule of thumb that we're using, that is relatively high by most standards, but because of the way that we are grazing on good pasture, we're able to work it that way. So currently with the poultry and the sheep all carved out, like at the cattle alone, we have give or take 40 head, and that's kind of the right balance point for us. And then we're calving, so we have new cattle coming in, growing, and then we're finishing off others. But hopefully we hit a steady state where then that herd is able to have all the food that they need, allow the landscape and pastures to continue to regenerate, and of course be throwing off all of that amazing grass-fed, grass-finished beef. But to your earlier point, I just wanted to add that I really do think of this as how we're regenerating a landscape. And I'm thinking of animals as my partners in doing that. And that's sort of the point of origin of thinking about scale or thinking about the farm. It's not, oh, I want to produce so much cattle, how can I fit that onto this land? It's very much to build a flourishing and abundant ecology on this land. What does it need? And how can I allow the animals through their unique contributions and the poultry, the ruminants, the hogs, they all work the land in different ways. They are my partners in basically restoring this into an amazing, healthy, and flourishing ecology. That makes sure that I don't dig myself into a hole where, or back myself into a corner where I have this production plan, but my land can't sustain it, and I'm just driving my farm into the ground, which is actually quite common. It's quite common for farms to fail ecologically, and that's why they have to buy in so many more materials. It's amazing if you don't have to buy things in and you're just able to work with the land in a way that can allow flourishing as well as production of amazing food and even jobs for the local economy.
Yes, that's certainly part of it. There's such a community that becomes very obvious, which is something the industrial age totally lost sight of, in my mind anyway. So to have this model in your farm, that gives you a lot of freedom in your bandwidth of being able to think about the farm and what other things can really work once you zero in. And in saying that, it's not a formula that you can take even from Alan Savory, is it? You really need to be here now in order to take advantage of the best case scenarios.
That's right. I think it's very context driven. And, you know, Savory Institute can provide amazing tools, but they don't provide any answer. That has to come from dialogue, ongoing dialogue with your landscape. Each year we'll look and that carrying capacity might go up or might go down for a variety of reasons. You know, we have huge swings in weather. If we have a long drought, if we have a 2-month drought, well, we lost that grass growth and that's not coming back. So, you know, our carrying capacity is also in relation to the weather and factors beyond our control. But back to the community, you know, we are doing farming that is, we call human scale. In the full season, we'll have 8 to 10. And then in the winter season, we'll have 2 or 3. But we're out there on our feet, using our hands, working the animals and working the land. We do have some quads and the tractor and all that. But the primary way that we're interacting with animals is on foot. And the primary way that we're creating all of our garden work and veg production is using our hands. And that, I think, also really is an important point of connection with the community, that we're able to train farmers. We have an apprentice program, so our staff are all wonderful men and women who are interested in learning about this type of farming, and that helps build a community around the farm because we're able to hire more people, and that also helps spread the word of how we're able to produce this amazing food and share it with our community. We don't ship. We're very much focused on building a local food system and having a lot of really rich touch points and connection with our customers. So we do tours, we do educational events, and all of that really helps establish us within a community, because I think that's also as necessary as supporting positive ecology is supporting positive community cohesion in a society that's as fragmented as we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Did you have one major concern, or maybe share a major concern you had when you were first getting started, and did it end up being your greatest challenge, or did the greatest challenge so far come galloping in from out of the blue?
Well, I mean, there's sort of the twin challenges of building your market and then also managing staff. I feel like the production is actually at some level the easiest side of all of this. Mm-hmm. Building a market as a new farm, the reality is the market for farm-to-table meat or veg is what it is, and it's really not growing rapidly enough. So we have a lot of farmers that would love to do what I'm doing, but the consumers, for some reason, just based on the way that society has trained us about food, they don't know how to cook, and they're not excited about shopping at farmers markets. So, you know, we have a market that prioritizes big box convenience 24/7, and then food that's ready to eat, that's very convenient, that doesn't need to be cooked. And those priorities in the marketplace do not align well with the food system that we're building in terms of small regenerative farms like Two Creek Farm. You know, we want to be able to meet customers at farmers markets, and we're selling products that many times require more understanding of cooking. I don't think it's hard to cook, but it just takes a little more knowledge. You know, throwing something in a slow cooker and running it all day is really easy, but believe it or not, people don't know how to do that with a whole chicken or a chuck roast or whatever that may be. And unfortunately, a lot of farms, they've already captured that market, and they really don't want to open it up to new farmers. And then on the staffing side, this is very hard work. Many people think they'd like to do this work, but when they actually see how hard it is, they don't want to do it.
Right.
So we had a lot of challenges with attrition, where we could put a job posting and get 1,000 applicants, and we could get a big percent of them to agree and show up here. But the reality is a very small fraction of those would conclude a full season with us. So, you know, we have to throw up all these hurdles, like, do you have a full season of experience? Do you have a history living in a rural environment? Can you be alone and do work alone and just sit with yourself psychologically? Mm. I think that's one of the challenges in this work. And then do you have the physical endurance to be out there, rain, snow, whatever's happening? So we really have to screen quite carefully, and we're drawing candidates from all over the country. We really have some from our immediate labor pool, but locally, but mainly we're pulling people from all over the country who really have passion for this.
It sort of made me laugh at how much common sense there was when someone started a dating site for farmers and ranchers.
It's a lifestyle. For the cattle are out at 8 p.m., I send a text out to the group chat, and we're all there in the field getting them back in. So that's above and beyond. The team we have here, they're excited by that, and they love that. But if that's not for you, we need to screen for that up front. Both of these, those are major factors in how I think about scale. And so one of the key things that I wanted was to be able to take some time off and to be able to not be in the position of having to run this farm every day, year in and year out. And in order for me to get that break and also to be able to focus on management and other types of planning, I needed to build out a crew and scale up to the degree that we could afford a crew that could work on the farm year round. To me, a key scaling consideration was to hit the point that I could have enough revenues and profit that I could hire a full-time team year-round. And this winter, we'll even have two staff in addition to myself all winter long. One of the challenges that farmers face if they don't have any labor, or and particularly if they don't have kids or a big family on the farm, you know, you have no option. Your back is to the wall.
You're smart to have thought of that and kept that in the forefront. And often it is something we need to work toward. I'd like to move on and just ask you about the crops that you grow. How do you supplement your pastures with seed? And then I'd like to move on to how your land dictated what you were going to grow with your vegetables.
Yeah, those are great questions. For the pastures themselves, we do no seeding. For the forests, when we're converting those over to pastures as well, we do no seeding whatsoever. I don't have the knowledge to know what to seed, and we have the richness in the seed bank already.
Nice.
So just philosophically and practically, I am operating at the level beneath the specific species, and I'm saying, well, what can I bring to allow this land to flourish? Clearly, grazing is a big part of that. The fertility through manure or through poultry, or even opening up more light if I need to take trees out and to reduce canopy. I'm sort of working at that level, and then the specific species that come in are exactly what are right, because that's what nature and Earth are determining, and I'm not making those determinations at all, and that's working extremely well. We have so many interesting species of grasses that come up, and so much diversity that we see in our pastures just by grazing it well and giving it the correct conditions to flourish. We do, on silvopasture, there's two approaches that we use. One is clearing and thinning more mature forests. And there is some selection of species, which do we cut and which we don't, and that has to do with where they are in the field itself in terms of creating more light coming in. But we do try to just ultimately lean towards more diversity, so we wouldn't take out one type of species exclusively, harvesting that. We just try to leave as much diversity as we could in our thinnings. But the other silvopasture is planting. We do plant a variety of new trees in various configurations in our pastures. Sometimes that focuses on water, and we use a system called Keyline from PA Yeomans. But when we think about trees then planting in pasture, you know, we're either focused on a crop, so we have a savanna-planted chestnut field that will deliver an amazing chestnut crop in a number of years, or we really focus on tree hay, the type of trees that animals can eat the leaves and use that as a way for supplemental browse in addition to the forage that the ruminants would have available on the ground. So that's a lot of species like black walnut, sometimes even massed in there like honey nut, or fruit like mulberry can also be helpful to some of the animals. But in general, willow, poplar, mulberry, a lot just based on the protein content of the trees. So yeah, pretty much aside from just setting up the pastures for success and then thinking about trees and what role trees play, we're not doing too much else aside from good grazing. We're not doing any reseeding whatsoever.
Yeah.
On the veg side, we have such amazing compost. I would say we're really in the business of producing compost more than we are of growing vegetables. If we get the compost right, then the vegetables take care of themselves and we can pretty much grow anything. The compost, the foundation to that, we're overwintering our laying hens, so that's a great opportunity to harvest their manure when mixed with wood chips and create compost all winter long. And then we also use litter from our brooders. We're raising 3,000 broilers and 500 turkeys. And so all of the litter from the brooders, when those birds are young and they need heat, they're all in confinement, that stage of their lives, to keep warm. And all of their manure is combining with the carbonaceous material that we provide to prepare and create amazing compost. So when we raise a batch of chickens, we start that with biochar, we start that with some peat, we start that with some pine shavings, and we'll even get some rock dust in there, so that then becomes a foundation for amazing compost. We're then using a no-till system of 30-inch beds, and you may be familiar with that. And we plant a range of vegetables. And we do that really mainly based on market and what we think will sell. So quite a bit of lettuce, spinach, those are really amazing sellers for us. But we also do beautiful tomatoes, bell peppers, eggplants, garlic, onion, potatoes, sweet potatoes, summer squash, winter squash, enormous sort of diversity of veg. But again, all of that grows well if we get the compost right.
Yes. Have you had an experience where you did not get it right?
Oh, yeah. I think we've been a pioneer in figuring out how to run laying hens all winter in a high tunnel and then plant in that just as the laying hens are leaving. So how do we process all of the manure from those laying hens all winter in a way that compost is usable in that spring, and we can plant right into there. Most people would use a skid steer and push all that out and let all that material sit for a year. But we had to develop a technique of mixing it twice a week all winter long. So it's a big project so that we can continue to finish that compost, even as those laying hens are in there. One year we failed, and that high tunnel was basically a manure lagoon, and we could not plant anything in there for that whole season. But through that, we learned and evolved to sort of figure out that right balance. And now the system is just amazing, where the laying hens, they have outdoor access, but otherwise they need shelter in the winter in this climate. So they have indoor access in a high tunnel from November to April, and then by May, we've got our tomatoes and peppers and eggplants. Mm. They're planted in, and they're just flourishing, and we can draw out about 80% of that compost and use that to fertilize the rest of our veg beds. But there was a lot of hard-fought learnings in that.
Mm. Is there a myth that seems to be still prevalent regarding regenerative agriculture that you're here to say is a myth?
Well, I would say regenerative is a term that is highly abused. So now everything is regenerative. I mean, the whole definition of regenerative to a certain degree is a myth, because everyone is saying they're regenerative. I mean, the worst abuse of the term regenerative is through its counterpart term no-till. So you'll have companies like Syngenta that claim they're focused on that they're regenerative companies and they're no-till. But the way we do no-till means we're not tilling the land and we're working it by hand and we're using compost. But in the Syngenta definition, no-till just means they're blasting it all with glyphosate and using a seed driller. And they're calling that regenerative when literally they're killing the soil, they're killing microbiology in every direction, they're decimating insect populations and everything in those fields with the huge volumes of glyphosate and other pesticides they're dumping on, and they're calling that regenerative no-till agriculture, and they're using the exact same words that we are. So that's an enormous abuse of the term. I think some people are even moving away from it. Any good term, companies will immediately co-opt.
Right.
And just develop their own definitions.
Yeah, it started.
So much confusion that the customers just give up. And we are USDA organic, and I do believe in the movement, but it has been diluted down based on pressures and the influence of companies. Certified organic now includes hydroponics, which doesn't make sense because obviously organic was all based on a foundation of healthy living soil.
Right.
So it's been sort of warped in so many ways. We are also a part of an amazing program called the Real Organic Project, and they're an add-on certification that's extremely farmer-friendly. Mm. And so they certify us on top of our USDA Organic cert for no charge, and they close off all of those loopholes.
Mm,
so you could
nice.
Be USDA organic like Driscoll's and be selling blueberries or raspberries that are not grown in soil. You could be USDA organic, but you could not be Real Organic Project organic. So they're taking a step in the right direction, and I'm very happy to be a part of that platform.
Yeah, so note to self, know your farmer, right?
I mean, I would say as a consumer, like if you go into Whole Foods, you will be so confused and manipulated by all of the packaging. You're going to feel like you're really buying amazing products, and it's just all complete garbage in terms of how that marketing is being manipulated and not reflecting the truth. Every farmer that's local and operating on a family farm, they all want to regenerate. Nobody is intentionally degenerating,
right.
And they'll have different practices, but they're all caring for the land and loving their animals and doing their best to regenerate their landscape because it's their home. at some level, a good proxy for regenerative is just a local farmer that is concerned with his or her land and wanting to connect with the community and produce good products. And does the farmer eat that food? You know, I would be very suspicious of any farmer that's not eating their own products. Farmers that are living on their land, eating their own product, that's probably going to be better than anything you could get in any grocery store, even the so-called fancy organic or regenerative stuff that you find in a Whole Foods.
Right. And when you were talking about the trees that you were starting to plant as supplemental browse, I just saw that on a menu. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
And now, for the cows today, we will have a supplemental browse of...
Exactly. There was one other element of scaling that I wanted to mention, and you can slot this in, but it's really thinking about partnerships. The farming culture is very much focused on being independent and being autonomous, and I think that can become a weak link. For example, we wanted to produce amazing honey on our farm and to benefit from all of the pollination, from having a large number of honeybees on the farm, but we just didn't have the bandwidth to take that on. So we were able to scale, but scale by working with a partner. So we found a beekeeper in the area who was interested in placing hives on our land, and now we have a sort of a joint project where we have 32 hives, and we're actually working with two different beekeepers.
Nice.
Who are then able to tend to those hives, because that's their specialization. But we're then able to, using our brand and our platform at markets, and the fact that this amazing honey is grown on our organic farm, it's produced on our organic farm, we're able to be a market channel for all of that production. So it's just a great example where I don't think we could have scaled to manage 32 beehives on our own, but
yes,
by kind of developing partnerships in the community with other beekeepers, we were able to really find an amazing way to add not only the honey that we're able to bring to market, to add that to our list of products, but to then bring all of that additional pollination to our vegetables, to our fruits, to our pastures, to our forests in a way that has enormous ecological benefits.
Beautifully said, and so true. So, Brent, do you have a favorite cut of meat that you enjoy?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let me give you a few. For beef, I love chuck roasts. I'll take an arm or an eye, and I'll also cut that into really nice stew cubes, and I'll braise that with wine and celery, onion, carrots. I love winter braises, particularly with those tougher beef cuts. In pork, I love our smoked pork chops. They are amazing. They've got loads of fat, beautiful meat, wonderfully smoked. And chicken, we do a really special cut. It's a deboned, skin-on whole leg. I love those on the grill. I'll sear the skin, crisp that up on the frying pan, flip that over, have that with some onions and bell peppers. Yeah, I love all of the food, and I pretty much only eat what we raise here. I do buy in coffee, I buy in chocolate, other things like that, but for my day-to-day diet, it's all the veg. So I'm eating, obviously, very seasonally. Everything's right from the farm, and I just feel like that really connects me to the land. It connects me to the animals. You know, another question that people often ask is, how as farmers do we eat animals that we love and care for? And I guess I kind of feel like, how would you eat an animal that you don't love and care for? You know, I feel like the connectedness and just the understanding of the law of nature, that all life is coming through death, coming through sacrifice, and the honesty and integrity of embracing that cycle and not just hiding from it and pretending that food in the grocery store was never alive on the hoof. To me, that whole game of pretending is harder to experience than the pain and the joy, and I guess to a certain degree, the gratitude in eating animals that I've loved and cared for until that final day of harvest.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You can take things down to so many minute levels, and if everything in life is energy, hey, what's to make a cow different than a potato or a tomato or a squash? Everything is alive and living. So the best we can do is care and have gratitude, I think.
That's exactly correct. I think life is life, and whether that's a plant, an animal, whether it's a cute animal or an earthworm or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And our life is deriving from the sacrifice of another life. That's just the most basic law of nature. There's a magic, I think, when you eat in that way and you bring that gratitude to an understanding of what's nourishing you and what's giving you life.
Brent, considering that you've experienced both the more politicalized views of farming and actually now farming, is there any policy or legislation that you would like to see or that you would like to see reformed and just out of there?
Yeah, I would like the removal of all government involvement in the agricultural sector.
Perfect answer.
I do a lot of work with the Farm Bill, and the reality is the Farm Bill, they should call the Agrochemical Bill, because it's just supporting a system of monocrops that no one is really making money out of except the chemical, the fuel, and the equipment companies. We call it a farm bill, but they're not the ones that are flourishing in that model.
Yeah.
And it's very ecologically damaging. That's producing the substrate for a toxic food system that floods the market with food that's not positive for human health at very low prices. And then it's hard for us to compete.
Of course.
Because we're paying the real cost of production. And the big companies have the benefit of government subsidies, government price stabilization. So the whole system is rigged against us. Farm Bill has nothing to do with food and nothing to do with farmers. Give me an even playing field. Give me a fair market and just get out. That's all I would ask for. But I would say that my experience, I think everyone needs to think clearly about food and to think clearly about the environment. I think it's really important that everyone have some connectedness to the food system, to the act of growing and raising food, that there's something deeply human about our desire and enjoyment of having our hands in the soil, of working animals. And I feel like if more people had some of that in their lives, whatever your professions are, to experience that connection, I think would inform a lot better environmental understanding, environmental policy, and ultimately food and farm policy.
Well, certainly we're all in the choir here. Lindley, I'm so happy to learn about the Real Organic Project. How did you get involved?
Back at the very beginning, I used to go to the Organic Standards Board meetings. National Organic Standards Board meetings are where decisions are made about what is and isn't allowed in organic. And the issue of hydroponic growing came up about whether it was allowed. And that got the attention of a lot of farmers. And I'm a farmer myself. I have a small direct market, farmer's market type farm growing vegetables. We specialize in tomatoes and those that get to the grocery store shelves. But I was very interested in this because the price of tomatoes was getting harder and harder to compete with. It was just dropping so much and they started tasting so bad. And we started looking into it. They were certified organic and they were hydroponic. So the message was spreading. And for the first time, the organic farmers were showing up to these policy meetings because they felt so strongly that organic was the heart of it, was about healthy soils and growing food in soil. So this issue meant a lot to them. And we actually lost. And so the Real Organic Project formed at the beginning of 2018, in January of 2018, in response to that.
Bravo. Yes. And it's important, I think, too, that this is a non-governmental agency, or I don't even want to call the Real Organic Project an agency. We'll just call it a nice project.
A farmer movement.
Yeah, and that's what needs to happen. Certainly, I know the Bronner's people and other folks have started a regenerative certification that is non-governmental, and it's just a beautiful part and parcel, really, of the organic and the regenerative movement. Being farmer-led, what are some basic, you just mentioned the hydroponic, what are some basic distinctions that do concern the members to avoid the whitewashing that goes on? And maybe share some of the more hidden ones. Hydroponics, that is kind of a hidden one from the general public who aren't really educated, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that even the farmers couldn't explain why it wasn't organic. They just knew it wasn't. All they think about is soil. And my co-director, Dave Chapman, is also a farmer. And the whole reason for this education has been also for us organic farmers to be able to explain to our customers why growing in the soil and raising animals on livestock, that is so central to organic, which most people just see as the elimination of harmful pesticides. So for us, we had to figure out how to communicate this. We kind of knew it in our DNA and in what we do, but we didn't know how to communicate this issue. And I think we're almost on podcast 300, and we're still learning ourselves about all of these issues. But we have a 15-member standards board, farmer-led, that's trying to figure out what our standards are. And of course, ROC and Real Organic Project, ROC is the Regenerative Organic Certification, we are both add-on labels to organic because that word is protected by law. And that's a difficult thing for a lot of farmers to overcome, is to get that certification. And, you know, of course, there's an internal debate about whether the USDA does own that word. But for 26 years now, the regulations were passed in 2000. We've been able to at least protect it from Bayer and Monsanto claiming that word. So there's pros and cons to, getting that legislation in place and getting a definition. But our standards are making sure that you are cultivating healthy soils on your farm. You know, even poultry, which if you're not moving those chickens, the nitrogen that they poop out, that will kill all the grass underneath. So our standard, because it requires living pasture, essentially mandates that these chickens are moving around on the pasture. And we also have a whole farm standard, which makes us, I think, unique. I know Biodynamic requires a whole farm commitment to their practices as well, just because we know that we can do this. There's no reason to have a portion of your farm that's conventional anymore. We know how to farm this way. When you have a split production, it makes it easier for there to be drift and cheating. So just a commitment to a whole farm standard is something that our standards board has always believed in.
Yes, and I just love this. I just feel so reinvigorated hearing about you all out there. Seeing that you have podcasts and your current event that's coming up has an amazing group of folks. What are your numbers like of farmers in the growth rate? And is it surprising everyone, or what's that like?
I don't know. I think we are at about 1,000 farms. You know, we lose 100 farms every year because organic is becoming more and more cumbersome for especially small farmers to jump through the hurdles. It's more expensive.
Yes.
Cost share disappeared for 2 years under Trump. It's back now. So hopefully that will help. But that is to offset some of the costs of certification. So all of these things just made it difficult. A really diversified farm has a lot of paperwork involved in, you know, making sure you're sourcing organic seed and then
yes,
all the way through to marketing. You know, we lose 100 farms every year and then we gain back, you know, a little over 100 farms every year. So the last few years, we've sort of maintained our membership at around 1,000. And we're fairly limited to where we can have organizers in the region to, you know, work with farmers to get them certified. So we've got an organizer in California, one in the Midwest, and then one in the Hudson Valley, New York area. And so we have a lot more farms in those regions where we've got people out in the fields talking to farmers about these issues.
And what about the cost? Oftentimes I'll see farmers either on the roadside or in farmers' markets. And especially in other countries, when you travel, it's organic by default because they can't even begin to afford organic certification.
Yes, it should be free. I mean, it's sort of like we should be making sure that the people spraying the harmful pesticides are getting certified to do that, not the people who aren't.
Yes.
The whole system
of
is
backwards.
Yeah. But the Real Organic Project certification is free because it was something that the farmers felt really strongly. There were already so many burdens placed on organic farmers for certification that we wanted to distinguish ourselves for these practices that we felt were just at the basic heart of organic that were disappearing under USDA, that,
yes,
you know, the cost of that shouldn't be put on farmers. So it's free.
Lindley, how, the why is very obvious, but how would a farmer get involved, the Real Organic Project?
Well, yeah, the best thing to do is just to visit our website and see if you agree with all the principles that we talk about. And if you feel like this is part of your movement, even if you're not certified organic, but you're using organic practices, share the podcast with your customers, because we're all trying to explain this food system that every single farm, whether you're certified or not, we're embedded in this food system that affects whether or not we can sell to our grocery stores, the price point that we get, you know, the consolidation in retail and distribution of our food. It has gotten so bad that often we're hearing from corporate headquarters that relationships that we used to have with grocery stores to buy local produce during the season, that's no longer available. So all of these issues affect all of our farms, and just sharing the content that we're creating and the issues with your customers will help your farm out. And, you know, you can feel part of a movement of organic farmers, even if you can't get certified. These issues affect us all.
Yes. And in saying that, quite a few listeners from my other podcast, which is not Regen Ag focused, are listening. So this is also for consumers. Even if you're never going to start a farm or a ranch,
yes,
if you just want to live as healthily as you can and spread the word, then everything Lindley just said, take heed.
Most of our podcasts are not about the how-to of production. It's about food system issues. You know, we pride ourselves in America with these gorgeous mollusols, you know, that were developed with these deep prairie grasslands in relationship with the herbivores. You know, we were so gifted with these beautiful soils, and we think we're feeding the world with them. And we are actually in a deficit of, I think it was $50 billion last year. So we are importing more than we are exporting. So we need to take a good hard look at our food system in the U.S. and acknowledge that we are actually exporting our agriculture to other countries. And with that, we really have lost touch with their production practices. And what kind of product are we getting now that we're selecting for things that sit on the shelf for a couple weeks, even longer, or, you know, are ripened by ethanol in the shipping process, or, you know, maybe have an organic label, but it's fraud. Get closer to our food chain so that we can actually know that the practices that we want to support and put into our bodies are actually the ones that the farmer is saying they are. Shorter supply chains, the better. These are the type of messages that we're trying to send to the customers.
Right. And I'm sure the community is such a plus, right? The people you've met and what you can learn from each other is just the big bonus there.
Oh, gosh, I think of it as a web where, you know, if you just pull one of those strands, everything is connected. So it's wonderful to continue to learn throughout life. And it's so fascinating, you know, everything from soil microbiology and the organisms down there to how that affects the flavor and nutrient density of the plant and how that's all interconnected to the climate. And you just never stop learning. It's a good community.
Many thanks to Brent Habig and to Lindley Dixon. For anything we do here, go to cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.
What love? life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true.